Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Okay, guys, you made it to the weekend. Congratulations. This is your Friday Roundup. And of course, I have Brad here with me in the studio. And today we're going to be talking about the ideas from the week, talking about this week's episode, and really exploring this wonderful world of financial independence. How you doing, Brad?
I am doing well, Jonathan. Yeah, everything's going well. Looking forward to the weekend for sure. What about you?
It's been a great week. I actually do have some pretty cool news. So my wife and I were able to use travel rewards to book a two-week trip to Cape Town, South Africa, taking our infant son with us, and it is going to be completely free. So that's a huge frugal win. Do I get the frugal win of the week award for that?
I think that is a win. So do tell. What kind of points did you use? You know, give us some info.
So I have probably 350,000 Chase Ultimate Rewards points sitting in my account right now. And I originally was going to try to use one of their transfer partners. I'm a big fan of United, thanks to Brad's input. And one of their partners is South African Airlines. And I tried to do that first, but they didn't have a lot of availability and the redemption really wasn't as good as I was hoping for. So I kind of went back to the drawing board. And since I have the Sapphire Reserve, which gives you a 1.5 cents per point valuation when you redeem it through the Ultimate Rewards portal, which makes it a great holding account for storing all of your points after you come to the end of the Chase Gauntlet. I was able to essentially just use that to book it, and I ended up getting two round trip tickets for me and my wife, and also my infant son as a lap carry for 128,000 points. So it was, it was great. It was really cool. And we're just going to visit family. So it's going to be a wonderful time.
Wow, that is so cool. That's an amazing redemption. So 128,000, you said?
128,000 ultimate rewards. And it was actually interesting because I was bringing my son as a lap carry. I had to call Ultimate Rewards to book the flight, and the attendant was very impressed at the amount of points I had. So I got some kudos from the Ultimate Rewards people as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Very cool. I remember we were talking about your redemption, and yeah, we looked through a bunch of options for actually transferring. Like you said, we figured that would be the best bet, but it wound up, and this is for everybody out there listening, it's always important to really look at every possible option, even if it's slightly unconventional, right? So normally we would say, oh, of course you want to use frequent flyer miles in the traditional sense because you're going to get a better redemption. Well, that sounds great in a vacuum, but until you actually prove out what it's going to cost you for a regular cash flight, right? Like if you go to United.com or Travelocity or Kayak or wherever it is, and you need to get that price. So I think that is the starting point. That's always my starting point, is just get some ballpark sense of how much a round trip flight is going to cost. So you really have some idea, like, does it make any sense for me to use miles? So like Laura and I are actually trying to book a vacation for us to Mexico around Christmas this year. And I wound up seeing a flight that incredibly had Delta Saver tickets from Richmond to Cancun, which I was absolutely shocked by, especially like around Christmas and Delta award availability. It was really unlikely. But the flight was only going to cost $200 for that one way, or they wanted 17,500 miles, which is the Saver level one way, plus $51 in unavoidable taxes and fees that you have to pay the Mexican government. So I was only going to save $150, and I would have had to have spent 17,500 Delta miles. So that's well less than 1 cent per point, which is a terrible redemption. So I realized very, very quickly that is not a good idea. So what we did when Jonathan was looking this up was he just kind of eyeballed how much is a round trip flight from Richmond or DC to South Africa. And it was coming in at right, Jonathan? Somewhere in the vicinity of about $1,000.
Yes.
So, I mean, that changes the calculus because you're going to spend for a round trip on United to Africa from the US, it's going to be 80,000 United miles. And considering that on international award flights, you do have to pay the taxes and fees to the country that you are going to, he was looking at probably about $100 in taxes and fees for each round trip. So he was only going to net a savings of about $900 because it was about $1,000 less the taxes and fees. So $900 savings for 80,000 miles. Now, that's not an ideal way to spend your Chase Ultimate Rewards points. But then the aha moment was, oh, wow, I have the Chase Sapphire Reserve. I get 1.5 cents per point when I book through the Chase portal. So Jonathan just logged into the Chase portal, searched those flights, and their search engine came back with something reasonable. And yeah, I mean, he was able to get it for $128,000 for the two round trips. And that's inclusive of taxes and fees. So it was only 64,000 Chase Ultimate Rewards points for each round trip. And instead of the 80,000 plus the $100 in taxes, going the standard method. So again, that's a long way of saying you really do have to look at your options and just kind of think broadly. As we always say here, it's just look at a problem a little bit differently. So it's definitely getting that starting point of what is the cash price. So I think this is a pretty good illustration.
Very cool. And we don't normally start with travel rewards, but I'm glad we did today. And if you want more information on how I accumulated those 350,000 ultimate rewards points, go to our website, chooseify.com/travel. That will show you all the information that we've collated to teach you how to do this yourself. And if you want to listen to our podcast, which in my opinion, and I'm biased, is one of the best resources on the internet for getting started with travel rewards, go to chooseify.com/009 or just go to episode 9. That's our travel rewards episode. And we will walk you through this beginning to end so you too can be traveling the world for free or nearly free. All right, now maybe we should start talking about this week's episode, the aspiring minimalist versus the reluctant frugalist. I think it came out really well.
Yeah, we got a lot of good feedback from this episode. I had a couple people definitely say this was their best episode ever. And I know a bunch of people definitely appreciate the psychological aspects of FI and when we delve into those subjects. And I know I'm, out of the two of us, I'm definitely the one that harps on that the most, because I think the psychology of investing, I think the psychology of saving and saving for the future, thinking decades down the road, this is not common. It's not difficult, but it's not common. So whereas you see your neighbors spending money and buying new cars and buying expensive houses and clothes and things like this, we're thinking a little bit differently. So to me, the psychology is absolutely essential. And I'm glad that we touched on it in this and gave you our different perspectives.
And I will say that I am probably not the best person to unpack minimalism. I was trying to research it a little bit for this particular episode. I know that this is a growing movement and that it is a powerful one once you latch on to it. And there are other podcasts that have really explored this now for several years. Books have been written about it. I think there was even a documentary on Netflix. So I'm sure there are better resources for exploring this concept in its entirety. But I think for the sake of what we were trying to accomplish this week, which is give you a place to start with the quote unquote uninitiated, someone that has not been exposed to FI before, it gives you a place to figure out how to start that conversation. Because if you can establish where someone is at, it helps you figure out a strategy to get this thing going.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as usual, after these episodes, I had a long talk with my wife, Laura, about the episode because she is an avid listener. And her point was about how to make this relatable for your spouse or significant other or just people in your life. And I think that is a crucial point. And we did touch on it a little bit. But I think what she wanted me to emphasize was, especially when you're trying to convince a spouse, a lot of people hear the word retire and they get scared to death because it evokes this thought of sitting on a couch for 10 hours a day watching NCIS reruns or something and just not having any value in life, essentially, just kind of sitting there wasting your life away. And that is not a pretty picture for people at all. And there's no easier way to get your significant other turned off from a conversation than by leading with this retirement concept, because I think that really is just so loaded with negative connotations. So for me, it's about that thought of we're a team and we can become wealthy for our entire lives and for generations to come, plus the added benefits of having this wonderful, happy life where we're working together, we get to spend more time together, we have a common goal. It's not just two people kind of getting through the week or month, buying this and that to make you happy for a short term. This is about long-term existential happiness, really. And that to me is how I would lead this conversation. And we do get a lot of questions of how do you talk to your spouse or significant other about this? And even though we just talked about it on Monday, I really did want to emphasize this because I think it is so crucial.
So Brad, I'm curious, as an aspiring minimalist and in general, someone that believes that less is more, tell us, what are the things that you splurge on, that money is no issue or that it is a backseat to quality? What is it that you're willing just to drop the dollars on?
Wow, that is a good question. I will answer that in a minute. But first, I just want to say, like, the aspiring minimalist, I think the more that I've thought about this, the more I'm not sure that I fit in to that definition by any means, as evidenced by our conversation on Monday, right? It's there. If there are all these little rules that require you being a minimalist, I'm not sure that I fit any of those. But to me, it's more of this mindset of I don't buy things just frivolously. I don't really like buying anything or even owning anything, like we've kind of joked about before. My ideal scenario in this alternate universe would be to basically own a suitcase worth of clothes and a laptop. And that's pretty much about it. That would be kind of like in my alternate bizarro universe, that would be about what I had. So possessions don't give me any satisfaction per se. But what's interesting, and again, I will get back to your question, Jonathan, but I've had this really fascinating back and forth conversation with one of our listeners. He's a doctor. His name is Bo. And we think very, very similarly. And he actually added something that I thought was fascinating. And he said, I'm going to read his entire email here. It's, I just listened to your latest podcast, Frugalist versus Minimalist. I enjoyed the dichotomy and identified with both, but it got me thinking. I think I am, and you may be too, neither a frugalist nor a minimalist, but a valueist. Isn't that what life is all about anyhow? Value. This might be why so many fire people don't fully retire. If you get value out of your work, or you value getting paid for a side hustle, then so be it. If you value having as little material possessions as possible, minimalism, then so be it. If you value frugality and or are motivated by a sense of scarcity, so be it. Valueist. And I think that is really cool. And it just kind of hit me. It hit me pretty hard that I think that is what I am truly. And it's funny because I've always used that term in my head and I buy what I value. So to me, it's not about a price tag. And it's hard to even verbalize how I arrive at this value.
It must be so frustrating to host a podcast and not be able to verbalize something.
It is indeed. Believe me, man. I wish I could do better for the audience. But I have to say, when it comes to a purchasing decision, I never think in terms of scarcity. I never think in terms of, oh, I don't have the money, or, oh, I don't want to spend $100 on that. Because at the end of the day, that's small fries. Like, nothing I'm buying is going to move the needle that much in terms of a percentage of net worth or even monthly income or anything like that. But it's, do I get some sense of value out of this? And I do have my own arbitrary sense of what that is. And again, as you can tell by me kind of stumbling over my words here, there's no succinct way to describe it, but valueist is definitely how I look at it. And I'm going to adopt that term from Bo.
Yeah. So did that exist before Bo sent that to you? If I were to type up valueist, is there a whole website or blogosphere dedicated to that concept? Or did he just make that out of thin air?
I believe that he made it up out of thin air. We can certainly Google it after the podcast.
It shall be Googled. No doubt about it. That appeals to me as well. It really does feel like it brings those different mentalities or concepts together.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And yeah, to try to double back to your question before, it's, in all honesty, I don't buy that many items. So I'm not sure that there's anything that I frivolously waste money on. I mean, I think one thing that I am very open to spending money on is for my health and fitness. And that's just become certainly much more so in the last year and a half, 2 years, where I've really made a focus on my health and fitness in general. And I'm in better shape now at 37 than I've ever been in my entire life, even when I played soccer in high school. And so I'm definitely not shy to spend money. Like I mentioned on a recent episode, I just joined CrossFit, and that is not cheap by any means. It's going to be probably a couple $1,000 or a little less than that after all is said and done for a year. I mean, that's a crazy amount of money, and it kind of freaks me out to say it out loud, but I am loving it. and it is certainly going to get me in great shape. I love the camaraderie. So I don't have an issue with that. I guess that would be what I spend money on without even thinking about it is health.
Brad, I love what you and Beau were talking about with the whole valueless scenario. And we got some feedback from some people in our Facebook community. And I think just for the sake of thoroughness and completeness, it's important to round out this discussion. We approached this from the perspective that we wanted to broaden the FI umbrella and we wanted to give people a way to talk to their spouses. But while we were talking about the differences between the aspiring minimalist and the reluctant frugalist, they certainly do have much in common. And we could have just as easily done a whole episode on the commonalities of those two approaches. And so Christopher messaged us and he said, "First, I love the podcast. Please keep up the good work. You're bringing a lot of value." He said, "I feel like you set up something of a false dichotomy in the last podcast. Frugality and minimalism are not mutually exclusive. It's possible to be both. Minimalism is not a monolith. There are lots of ways to be a minimalist, and some of them could be very spendy. I think the two philosophies support each other nicely." And Jessica said she just wanted to add she's not a fan of all the rules described in our particular podcast. She said there's no such thing as a true minimalist. You don't have to own a certain number of things, get rid of a certain amount of things in a timeline, dress a certain way, or spend a certain amount of money. It misses the whole point entirely. Minimalism is a process. There is no destination. It's a journey. It's discovering what is most important to you, activities, possessions, people, and continually focusing your resources on them, time, attention, money. It's uncovering your values and aligning your life with them. I think that that is great perspective that I do not disagree with in any way. And so just for the sake of putting it out there, there are certainly many different ways to tackle any conversation or any topic that you want to have. And I love that we could take an extra second to come back and bring in some other people's information and input into this conversation.
Yeah, agreed. I think they were both very value-added comments for sure. Yeah, I agree with Jessica entirely that these arbitrary rules, they feel wrong to me. It just doesn't sit well. And if that, again, is what's required to be a minimalist, then I'm out, basically, because I don't like arbitrary rules that have no basis in anything. But I liked her focus on it being a process, being there's no destination to this. It's a journey. So I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think that is where my quote unquote aspiring minimalism comes into this. So to me, it's just about the thought process of trying not to just be overburdened by stuff in the house all the time and just really get to what's essential, get to what we use. So that definitely rang true. And yeah, if Christopher, hopefully we didn't intend to set up a false dichotomy by any means. And it wasn't like some kind of crazy like clickbait, like, oh, the aspiring minimalist versus the reluctant frugalist. And I agree that these are very, very similar and they dovetail nicely. And that's the thing. We're just trying to explain more than anything here that Jonathan and I approach life very, very differently, but it's very similar at the end of the day. That's the funny thing. We have the same ultimate goals. We just have a slightly different perspective. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's the crucial point for the audience to understand is that you can approach almost any of this stuff with what you value and what is important to you. So at Choose FI, at least, there are no rules that make you in or out. This is about just being a little bit smarter and just getting a little bit better, really in every aspect of your life. That's how I approach my life and my FI journey.
I love that. I want to say, though, and I hinted at this at the end of the episode, I would have never in a million years, or at least in 31 years of my life, considered myself even willing to contemplate minimalism until right now, this year. And it has gotten more and more appealing to me. And so I'm going to make this announcement in a few weeks, and I'm not going to tell you exactly what it is, but it's very exciting. It has to do with 1500 days and FFLC, and I'm going to leave it there. And I'm going to play this message that we got from Jeffrey. And I wanted to set the stage because I'm actually planning on doing a version of this challenge. And maybe it's something that somebody else in our audience can benefit from as well. Because I think if you find yourself wanting to be a minimalist in training, sometimes you just need a place to start and you're ready to do what Brad did and create some sort of oasis in your life, then maybe you're willing to be what Jeffrey's going to call a minimalist in training, at least in the short term. And so let me go ahead and pull up this voicemail. Hang on just a second, Brad.
Hey guys, love the podcast. Calling in response to your most recent episode on minimalism. Before joining the FI community, I consider myself an aspiring minimalist. I think there's a lot of core values that are similar between the two communities. One of the things that sort of one of the hacks that I've used over the years is curating my closet. And what I mean by curating my closet is only having a closet with the essentials that I deem worthy of keeping and I feel look the best on me. This is also a good practice. So now I don't have to really deal with the paradox of choice, waking up in the morning and spending 20 minutes or 30 minutes trying to decide what to wear. Now I can spend my mornings doing things that are more meaningful to me, like drinking coffee, listening to a record or some music, reading a post, listening to a podcast, maybe doing some light exercise. It really clears up my morning. And so when I leave the house, I feel like I'm starting my day off on a good note. So anyway, the way the hack works is this. Over 30 days, what you'll do is you'll go into your closet. You can pick any day and purposely turn every hanger around in your closet. Now, when you start, what you'll do is you'll just go into your closet normally and just pull out the things that you use on a normal week or day, whatever the case may be. You'll wear those things. And at the conclusion of the day, you will put them back on the hanger and put them back into your closet the normal way you'd put a hanger in. Now, you'll continue to do this for 30 days. And at the conclusion of 30 days, what you'll do is you'll look in your closet and you'll just sort of look to see, okay, where are the hangers? The hangers that are put in the regular way are the items that you'll keep, and those that are not, or in the irregular fashion, are things that you've not touched, are to be discarded, donated, or sold. Because if you haven't touched it for 30 days, chances are you won't touch it for another 30 days, and it's just sort of taking up space.
And Jeffrey actually posted on our Facebook community group, and he says, I can't even begin to tell you how liberating it is to wake up in the morning and select your wardrobe in less than a minute. I no longer have to deal with the fatigue of choice, and I'm also confident in my wardrobe since it only includes items that provide comfort and, in my opinion, make me look my personal best. Now, just to set this up in contrast, he says, alternatively, my wife feverishly spends 15 to 20 minutes trying to decide what to wear and often changes her wardrobe at the last second. I used to lecture my wife on the issue, but it made very little progress. Once I made the changes and my wife started to see how simple my mornings were, she started to make the small, simple changes herself. There's so many amazing points to pull from this post. And one of the biggest ones is, instead of just talking at somebody, model it for them. That's what he did. So instead of just trying to convince her with logic, he actually just went ahead and did it himself. And she was able to see the benefit for his life and then make a decision based on that instead of just someone shoving his ideas at her. And I think that's messaging that you don't need to confine to this one particular conversation. I think that's a tool that you should absolutely be considering anytime you're trying to convince somebody of something. Don't just talk the talk, walk it, model it for people. That is powerful. And Brad, I have three closets of clothes that have just been accumulated. They may not even fit anymore, frankly, but I've just been terrified to get rid of them in the off chance that I might actually need them at some point down the road, or that they will fit again at some point down the road. And then I wouldn't want to have to repurchase them. There's probably like less than a 10% chance that I wear 30% of those clothes ever. But my frugal brain that didn't want to risk wasting money was unwilling to go through those closets and claw that stuff out and actually donate it or get rid of it. That ends now. I'm tackling it. That's going to be my project for middle of August. I'm going to do this. And Jeffrey, and to anybody listening that's interested, I will report on that at the beginning of September. I fully anticipate to have decreased my wardrobe by 30% starting into September because of this episode and how empowering that message was.
Wow, that's really cool. Let me just stop you. You have three closets worth of clothes? Is that for real?
It's like painful, dude. I just can't throw stuff out. It's bad.
Wow.
I don't even know if it fits. Like, it's just, I'm not even sure. I'm sure it doesn't look good if it fits. It'd be probably horrible, but it's just, yeah, it's still there.
Wow.
But I got a great deal on it, so it was okay.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you did.
It was 25%
off. That's by 300.
It was 25% off, man.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, I've definitely gotten rid of the vast majority of my clothes. I could easily fit them in one little dresser at this point. But yeah, you'll enjoy that process because you'll find that realistically, if you said 30%, you're probably wearing 10% of that stuff on a yearly basis.
Oh, 5%, dude.
Yeah.
5%.
But yeah, the one thing that I like Jeffrey mentioned, I no longer have to deal with the fatigue of choice. I did kind of allude to this in the prior episode, and I'm going to link to the Wikipedia entry on decision fatigue. This is definitely, if you don't keep up on psychology and the latest research, you probably haven't heard of this, but this is like an actual real thing. And actually, I'll just read the first paragraph here. In decision making and psychology, decision fatigue refers to the deteriorating quality of decisions made by an individual after a long session of decision making. And that can even be, this is my own editorial here, that could be like a day. So it doesn't have to be a session of decision-making. It is now understood as one of the causes of irrational trade-offs in decision-making. For instance, judges in court have been shown to make less favorable decisions later in the day than early in the day. And it says decision fatigue may also lead to consumers making poor choices with their purchases. So yeah, I mean, clearly, I think it benefits your brain to make as few decisions as you have to, especially on just the background stuff of life. So try to take decisions out of the breakfast you eat, especially early in the morning. Have a morning routine. I know I have a routine every morning where I get up, I stretch, I listen to the Headspace meditation app for 10 minutes. I read a book. Just do these things every single morning. And I know exactly what my breakfast is. I know essentially exactly what I'm going to wear that day because it's just a pair of athletic shorts and a t-shirt. And I don't have to make a ton of these crazy decisions early in the day because I know it's going to make me, if I had to do that, it would make me less mentally agile later in the day. So this is a real thing, as bizarre as it sounds, if this is the first time you're hearing about it, but definitely try to cut out just some of the needless decisions from your life if you can. And I guarantee you it'll make a big difference.
It's so good that I feel compelled to actually finish this up. Jeffrey provides the tips on how to completely get rid of 60% of your wardrobe and feel good about that decision coming away with it. And so for step two, let me go ahead and play the last part of this voicemail.
So now step two is to take the items that you did keep and to do what I call an aesthetics check. Now, what I mean by that is pick either a Saturday or Sunday or any day you deem suitable and just try every item on that you have remaining. Look in the mirror and just really be honest with yourself and ask yourself, do I truly love this or do I not truly love it? You look in the mirror and you say to yourself, oh, it's a nice shirt, but it doesn't quite fall right, or it's expensive. I mean, a lot of us hold on to things because we feel it's a good value or we paid a lot of money. And what it does is it really promotes no joy. And we're just holding on to try to get some type of return on that initial investment. And you have to get that out of your mind and just discard it. And at the conclusion of that 30 days, if you go through the aesthetics check and the 30-day game, you'll find out that you'll have a finely curated closet of only items that you feel look good and feel good in. And then also when you wake up, when you have limited choices, it literally takes me about a minute to pick what I'm going to wear. Oh, it's 80 degrees, short sleeve shirt and my brown slacks. Oh, it's cold. Oh, brown slacks. Let's use one of my sweaters. So it just makes my life so much easier. Now, from a financial standpoint, it's also beneficial, seemingly because I purposely decide what I bring into the closet. I don't bring in trendy fashion or things that I cannot use over a long period of time. I don't buy sale items that are irregular that may be good, but there's a reason why they're on sale that are irregular. Maybe there's a button that's off or a sleeve that's a little longer, or maybe it's a little bit tight around one part of the body that doesn't look very flattering. So I've eliminated that, and I can pretty much confidently say over the last year, I've probably spent less than $300 in total in buying or bringing in new clothes. The only time I've spent money is maybe taking a shirt that I bought previously and it got a little bit tattered and I replace that exact same shirt, discard that, and I have a new one. Love the podcast. Look forward to the upcoming episodes and thanks a lot.
Yeah, that aesthetics check that he mentioned is definitely rings true to me. I know there were shirts that I used to love that I had in my wardrobe that I would wear once a week or once every other week that I put on recently and they just don't feel right for whatever reason. They just sit wrong. And I'm not a especially vain person or anything like this, but I think a lot of these t-shirts that I mentioned to you guys last episode about how half my wardrobe is basically from free shirts I've gotten from FinCon. And these companies go all out. They buy these really good material shirts like the 50-50 shirt from American Apparel and they just fit well. You just feel good when you're wearing them. And my old shirts that I actually had some attachment to, I got on in Hawaii on my honeymoon or something like that. I wear them now and they just don't feel right. So at this point, I'm not wearing those shirts anymore. And I've really donated essentially all of them. So at this point, honestly, my entire wardrobe is free shirts from FinCon, which Jonathan, you can certainly attest to.
He does indeed. It is FinCon and Choose FI gear. And that's about all I've ever seen him wear in the 1.5+ years that we've known each other.
Yeah. And you will see them for the next 10 years because I stock up at FinCon every year.
It's going back this year, right? Double dipping.
Yeah, you bet, man.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for sharing that with our community. I personally have received value from that information and plan on implementing it. Very much appreciated. Thank you to everybody for posting your feedback on this episode. Most of these ideas come from our Facebook group. And if you want to join that conversation, you can go to chooseify.com/Facebook. There's a simple opt-in form, and we will send you the link to the private Facebook group, and you can join the community. This is more and more the resource that we're relying on to figure out how we can make this message even better and more applicable to the life that you're living and your specific scenario. And so we want and need your feedback in order to make the show even better. So thank you for participating in that dialogue. So a book kept popping up on our Facebook community group this week, and Joe was the first one to mention this. And this book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing. He says that on Sunday, him and his wife started this method. So this episode was very timely. And the focus of it is to tidy up and do so in two phases. And it really walks you through this process and kind of changes your mentality. It gives you permission that you may not have felt that you had to discard all the old stuff that you're hanging on to. And that sense of freedom is constantly what we refer back to in the FI community. So we'll link to that book in the show notes. Someone was saying there's actually a free version of that audiobook on YouTube that you can listen to. So maybe that's something that's worth checking out as well.
Yeah, I read that book a couple years ago when it came out, and it definitely resonated with me for sure. I know it's sold millions of copies. So this is an extraordinarily popular book. There were a couple things, and we saw some of these comments in the Facebook group, where there are a couple things that are a little hokey about it, where it's about literally talking to your clothes and seeing what sparks joy. And if you can get beyond that, and I'm not trying to minimize the message by any means or make fun of it, because there are people that certainly get a ton of value out of every aspect of this book.
Including talking to your clothes?
Yes, including talking to your clothes. But if you can put, I don't want to ever needlessly make fun of people, but if you can put that aside, if you happen to be very skeptical of that, like I was, you can still get a ton out of this book. So don't pick it up, read the first chapter and say, oh, this is a little weird. It's got a great message. And I know people who have literally donated 20 garbage bags worth of possessions after reading this book. I mean, it changed their entire lives. And I would highly recommend grabbing it from the library. I guarantee you they have a copy or multiple copies at your local library. And we will link to it in the show notes just so you have the author name and the title.
So Brad, I think that there is room to make just a very slight pivot here, because the entire episode was predicated on the idea of how do you start this conversation with a spouse or significant other. And while that's extremely valuable and applicable to everyone that's listening to this podcast, there is another angle to this that we could have easily made, another pitch, and that is, how do you have this conversation with friends and coworkers, and what do you do when you start to get blowback? And we're going to riff off this and kind of talk about our own experiences. But I think it's important for me to go ahead and point out that what inspired this for me was an article that came out earlier this year that I just saw on Twitter within the last couple of weeks by Mad Money Monster, who we'll link to in the show notes, madmoneymonster.com. But this article was called Early Retirement Resistance When Friends Push Back. And I've really enjoyed her blog. I've read a bunch of her articles that have popped up on Twitter over the last several months. And this particular one was dealing with this idea that she's still in her job. She's working towards FI, and she has to hide this aspect of herself. And when everybody got their bonuses and they were talking about how they were going to spend it at that particular time of the year, it was a great conversation. But when she said that she was going to take her bonus and use it to max out her 401k, dark clouds crossed the sky, blocking out the sun, right? And she realized that just by saying that, she had kind of put herself on the other side of an invisible line. And she actually got some blowback for some team members. And it was hard for her to understand why that had happened, and also how to grapple with how to avoid that going forward. I thought this was a really interesting conversation. So we'll link to her article in the show notes so that you can read that entire article. Very, very interesting story. And so we're both going to tackle this both from the construct of work and also friends. And I'm going to start just by talking about it in the context of work. I learned somewhere along the way, I'm a very open guy. It comes through on this podcast. There was no alias needed. I don't have a moniker. I'm very much in the open, even though I'm still at work. Having said that, I am cognizant of the fact that there is an invisible line there. And in the workforce, when everybody else is talking about their water cooler show, and you change the conversation and talk about your plan to retire, not in the unforeseeable future, the 20-year 40-year timeline, but in the now, in the 5, 10-year, 15-year plan, and you start making these unconventional choices, like taking your money and instead of blowing it on stuff, you're maxing out your 401k, I think that there is very much room for negative blowback if it's done the wrong way. And I think that it requires some discretion. I think it's very easy to have this conversation. And I think she found this out in the article as well. If you can capture someone's mind as they're just starting the job, it's very easy to act as a mentor and they will buy that entirely. But when you're talking to someone that's been at their job for 20 or 40 years and they've already made their choices and they're kind of locked on that hamster wheel, a positional fire's been calling it the hedonic treadmill. That's a much more visual image. And I got to say, it's a better phrasing, but I'm going to stick with the hamster wheel. But for that person that's already made those decisions, to a degree, they are going to feel judged by your decision because you're making a different choice.
So have you actually had this conversation with anyone in your real life and faced some either blank stares or any of that blowback that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think this is the difference. So at my job, I'm essentially the boss of my team. I am the upper management. And so to some degree, when I'm talking about these concepts, I can say it without fear. You know, if I go about it the right way and I don't overly expose myself, but to some degree, I can go ahead and say this stuff. I will say, though, that I would not say this stuff to my upper management. I feel like there would be some very real damage to your career by putting this information out there too soon. I think it does put you in an adversarial role from a management looking down at you perspective. I'm thinking about it in terms of annual reviews. I'm thinking about it in the context of raises, bonuses, all of those different scenarios. And I think it puts you in a negative place from a management looking down on you perspective. I'd love to get ESI's thoughts on this, actually. I'm sure that if he were your boss, that would probably be a great boss to have. But for your normal run-of-the-mill management, I could see them viewing an employee that had this mindset as a threat because you're essentially, if you corrupt other people with these ideas.
So meaning the concept of I'm going to retire in 5 to X number of years, as opposed to, hey, I max out my 401k and I save my money in Vanguard. Like, is there some, you know, I guess A, I'm looking for some clarification on that, and B, like, is there space to subtly inform people about the real pillars of FI without ramming it down people's throats of, oh, I'm going to retire in 7 years when that might be such a foreign concept to them that they just recoil and just don't listen to you, really? Like, so I guess just give me some more information.
Well, to put it simply in terms that the FI community understands, if you empower a bunch of employees with FU money, that's not always a good thing for upper management. I think that you need to start in the right place. So I think you probably would want to start with more of the Dave Ramsey approach with your peers. The idea of pursuing being debt-free. I think that's a completely fine, non-controversial conversation to have, talking about your financial freedom clock and talking about not having the burden of student loans and consumer debt hanging over your head. I don't think there's any controversy there. I think that that's a conversation you can have. You don't really need any discretion in order to start that conversation. I think that in that context, you can also talk about starting to max out your 401k. I think that's probably fine if you're talking about that after you've already had the other conversation talking about pursuing being debt free. But I think once you start moving past that and you start talking about financial independence and early retirement, I think that you need to be very cautious with how you have that conversation in the workforce, especially with your upper management. I think 1500 days to some degree may have felt that because he was keeping that under the belt and essentially using an alias on his website. I think people that are in the workforce right now and that are talking about financial independence, for the most part, they're using monikers. And I think that they sense that as well, that there could be some negative blowback talking about this idea of FI. Because essentially what we're talking about is if you're really exploring what your passions are and putting all your time and your energy into developing that, something's got to give and it might be your job.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of validity to that, certainly. And I think people rightfully can be a little wary of mentioning this at work, certainly as overtly as that. I think just like anything in life, you have to know your audience and you have to know your relationships. So like for me at my old job before I left a couple years ago, there was one person who was nominally my boss. So he was definitely my, you know, the person I reported to, but he was also my closest friend at work. And I knew that he was very financially savvy. And we just had a ton of fun talking about a lot of this stuff over a course of 5 to 7 years and just kind of comparing notes. But it was never like, oh, I'm going to retire at 39. It was, So that didn't come into it. Not that it would have been awkward, but maybe frankly, that wasn't even in my plan. I don't know that I had a particular date, but if I did, I don't know that we necessarily would have talked about it on that level. But whereas I easily spoke with him, I would not have talked about this as openly with the VP, the next layer up. We talked some financial things, and I think he certainly knew I was pretty savvy, but I don't think I ever mentioned any of these five blogs or anything like that. So you have to know your audience. And I think that's also how I've been able to turn some of my friends onto Fi just in the last 4 or 5 months since Chooseify has been around. Like I had mentioned on previous episodes, I kind of stepped outside my comfort zone a little bit, and not that it's self-promotion, but I wound up telling my friends about this podcast because I think it resonates with regular people. And I think it's a good intro to this concept that, Jonathan, you and I consider a life superpower. So to deprive people of that almost seems like, especially people who would be open to it, it just seemed needless. And I did step outside my comfort zone and did get in touch with, you know, maybe 5 to 10 friends who I knew had some level of financial savviness and interest and maybe even save some money. You know, just these kind of little things just that I've picked up over the course of knowing them for years and years and years. So again, know your audience just anywhere in life. Like if you talk to the guy next door who just bought 2 new BMWs and you see they're wearing expensive clothes and going to, you know, Tahiti every year, well, maybe that's not the right person for the message right now. So I think it's just finding those people who might be open to it. And then once you have a handful of people in your social circle or your work who are interested in Fi, well, then you start talking about it around the table and other people over here. You know, there's a way to slowly get people involved in it. So I think that would probably be my method. But to walk up to the proverbial water cooler and say, hey, guys, I'm saving 70% of my income and I'm going to retire in 4.5 years. Well, of course, they're going to think you're crazy, right? Like you're just asking for it. So if you go about it with the wrong strategy, you're going to get the wrong answer. In summation, know your audience and pick and choose the people that you think would be open to this.
And man, how lucky would that person be for you to share this idea with them if they were ready for it and heard it in the right way? That is the definition of something gone viral, right, Brad?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I have multiple friends of mine who email me a few times a week and talk about their Fi plan and how this has really changed their entire lives. And that's just in my tiny little social circle of the people that I've even been willing to tell them about the podcast so far. So if everyone out there who's listening to this can be just an evangelist for it in that small little way, find a couple people. And this is not about growing Chooseify. I mean, that's irrelevant. We want to grow this movement because this will change lives. Find the couple people in your social circle, your friends, your coworkers, who might be open to this just based on little conversations that you've had. You know, you have to be aware, clearly, but let them know about Mr. Money Mustache. Send a couple posts. Let them know about our episode 21, The Pillars of Fi. Like, that's a good way to get started, right? And you never know if in a couple of years you have a group of people basking in the actual Fi, right? And you all just have a better life. So, I mean, that would be the way I'd approach it.
There are now tens of thousands of people in our community, and there are a significant percentage of those people, just because they have been digesting this information for years now. And so they were some of the first to find us because they were just looking for that next messaging, that they are within 2 or 3 years of Fi. Maybe they're within a year of Fi. And if you can cultivate that same sense of community in your own social circle, the power of having your set of friends all kind of retiring in that same 5 to 10 year window, that is incredible. The benefit that has for them also benefits you. It's one thing for you to have freedom all by yourself, but if all of your friends are still stuck at their 9 to 5, who are you going to hang out with? So you're helping them out by helping them discover this message and discover this, that freedom is optional for them as well. They can make a choice to get that freedom sooner. So I love the idea of spreading the message, but do it with a strategy. All right, so a few updates from our in-house experts. Millionaire Educator just released his 2017 free money tax tables. I use that as a reference for myself each year when I do my tax planning, and I think that you should consider that as well. So we'll post a link to that in the show notes. Brad, I think we have some input from Big Earn as well, right?
Yeah, we do. One of our listeners, Mark, wrote in a question, and I sent it over to Big Earn, even though I was pretty sure of the answer, but it's always better to get clarification and confirmation from Earn, since he is the expert on all things technical. So Mark wrote, I'm in the process of rebalancing my portfolio and rolling over a Roth 401k from a former employer. And I find myself once again debating the merits of converting all my existing tax-sheltered Roth assets from index funds to ETFs. Currently, I hold all taxable assets in Vanguard ETFs and all IRAs and retirement accounts and Vanguard index funds. I'm aware of the most widely publicized advantages of ETFs over index funds, which are intraday trading ability, historically lower expense ratios, tax efficiency, etc. However, intraday trading doesn't interest me, and there is currently no difference in expense ratios between most of Vanguard's Admiral Share index funds and their comparable ETFs. This leaves me with the question of whether ETF shares held in Roth accounts offer measurable advantages over index funds due solely to their tax efficiency. I have a high level understanding of the differences in the way that index fund shares and ETF shares are constructed and redeemed, which can result in lower capital gains for the ETFs. But does minimizing an ETF's capital gains distribution actually produce any tax benefit or other cost savings for a shareholder who holds the ETF's shares in a Roth account? All right, so that was Mark's question. And I asked Earn if he should record a voicemail to this. And he said, hi, Brad. No, that's a quick one. No need to record anything. The ETF advantage over the index fund doesn't apply in the Roth, just as you, Brad, suspected. You don't have to worry about capital gains distributions in mutual funds because in the Roth, everything is tax-free. Same applies also to tax-deferred accounts like an IRA, 401k, 457, etc., where the taxable event only occurs when withdrawing funds. In fact, Earn says, the mutual fund has a few advantages over the ETF. One is no commissions when buying and selling. Two, no commissions when reinvesting dividends. Three, no bid-ask spread when buying or selling. And four, easy rebalancing from one mutual fund to another with the same day transfers and guaranteed end of day prices. And five, you can buy fractional mutual fund shares, i.e. no idle cash sitting around. For those reasons, I prefer index funds in all my tax advantaged accounts. Just like you, I'm a long-term investor and I don't care much about intraday liquidity. But of course, since the expense ratios are the same, I don't see a need to liquidate all the ETFs. I would probably just invest new funds and ETF dividends into VTSAX if that gets you over the 10,000 minimum investment for Admiral shares. Best of luck, Big Earn.
Wow, that's a great answer by Ernie. He really highlighted some of the features of these tax advantage vehicles. So very much appreciate that input.
Yeah, agreed. This was a very helpful look from both Mark and Earn at the differences and advantages, disadvantages between ETFs and index funds. And that's actually the main reason why we're reading it here, because a lot of people have questions about that. And I think those guys did a wonderful job of explaining it, so I don't need to add anything further. But there are some slight differences, but I think it's at the end of the day, it's hard to go wrong with either Vanguard low-cost ETFs or index funds, though I choose index funds personally for the reasons why Earn detailed in his five bullet points.
All right, so we have an announcement today. Noah from MoneyMetagame.com has agreed to come on and essentially be an in-house expert for us, and he is going to be helping us with FI life hacks. And Noah, this guy knows the math. He spends a lot of time digging into the math, and he knows how to apply it to help you game out the everyday aspects of your life. And he has tons of ideas and he wants to share them. So he's going to be drip releasing them over the coming months, hopefully maybe 1 to 2 voicemails per month, and just sharing these tips that he's figured out over time that you can use just to execute your FI game plan and maybe get you a little bit closer to your goal in a slightly more math optimized way. So I'm excited to play this. Brad, give me just a second. I'll go ahead and pull this up.
Hey, everybody. This is Noah from Money Metagame with another life hack. This one is all about using discount gift cards for purchases you're going to make anyway. You may have given or received gift cards as a gift in the past, but a lot of people don't think about buying gift cards for themselves. This, of course, doesn't benefit you if you're paying full price, but that's where the discount part comes in. There are a lot of gift card exchanges online that sell secondhand gift cards at a pretty steep discount, and it's really easy to find them using a website like giftcardwiki.com, which aggregates all of those exchanges in one place. Hopefully Jonathan will be able to put a link to that in the show notes. You can find many stores and restaurants with gift cards at 10 to 20% off, and most of them can be delivered instantly electronically. One important thing to note is how long the website guarantees the card's value for. So make sure you plan to use it within that time frame. The best part about using these gift cards is that they stack with any other discounts like promo codes and shopping portals that you might already be using. The gift card is just a different form of payment after all of those discounts are applied, so you're saving even more money on top. As with any life hack that quote unquote saves money, the most important part is to question whether or not you really need to make that purchase in the first place. I find it's best to work backwards from a purchase I need to make, first searching to see what stores have it at what prices, then looking further to see what discounts I can apply at those stores, including discount gift cards. If you start by looking at available discounts and then try to brainstorm different ways you might be able to utilize them, you're almost guaranteed to fail at actually saving money. One of my favorite ways to utilize this trick is when I'm out shopping with my wife. While she is picking out clothes and trying them on, I can pull up Gift Card Wiki on my phone to see if there are any discount gift cards available for the store we're standing in. If she finds something she wants, then I can purchase the card through my phone and have it ready to use by the time we get to the register. An actionable tip that you can take with you is to look over your purchases for the last few months. Look at any big chains that you shopped or ate at, then look those brands up on Gift Card Wiki to see if you could have gotten a discount on those purchases. Once you get a feel for which places offer good discounts, just remember to check Gift Card Wiki the next time you make a trip or purchase online. Thanks, Brad and Jonathan. Keep spreading the fire.
All right, the fire is spreading. That's awesome. That is a great tip. So a lot of times we go to TJ Maxx. It's just part of our kind of bi-weekly roundup type things. It's our grazing pastime. And I can't quite seem to cut it, but I find myself not really knowing what to do anymore when I get there. Like I'm just kind of holding my hands. And I think maybe going forward while I'm on the team, I might just log into this wiki site and see what I can find and see if maybe I can, while my wife is maybe purchasing whatever it is that she's getting, maybe I can just game it out by 10 to 15% another way.
Yeah, that's cool. Definitely a lot of avenues for saving here. So yeah, I'm going to look into it and certainly tell Laura about this.
Yeah, because she's the expert shopper, right?
Yeah. It's certainly not me. I haven't barely stepped foot into stores. So
Laura, I locked down this life hack for you. Enjoy.
Nice. Yep. She'll love it.
Okay. For our last message that we wanted to do today, Marilyn sent us a voicemail challenging our sacred cow, which was used cars. And Brad and I started this entire show around the idea that we're not dogmatic about anything. We can be convinced, but you got to present your case. So that's what this is. Hang on just a second, Brad. I'm going to pull this up.
Hey, Brad and Jonathan. Okay, I'd like to get right to it. The last few times I've listened to you to Choose FI, you guys have mentioned how it's important to always buy used cars, and that's the only way to go. And for some reason, that really riles me up every time I hear that. So for this voicemail, I'd like to challenge the sacred cow of always buying a used car. In all the examples I've seen different personal finance bloggers and even you guys give, people are buying a $25,000, $35,000, $40,000 car. And then there's the assumption that the owner will be done by another new car in 2 years and take a huge depreciation hit. I don't think it necessarily needs to be that way. We've actually decided to buy both of our current cars brand new with a few stipulations. We decided we were not going to spend any more than $17,000 for everything. We also financed the car with a dealer promotion, and both of our cars we got for 0.9 and 1.9% financing. The other stipulation we have is we do not step foot into a dealership without having an emailed agreement of the final price. So what we do is we do competitive bidding off of other dealers. So I send them an email and say, hey, I'm interested in a Toyota Yaris. What is the best price you can give me? And then I bounce that price off of another dealership. And I just keep going back and forth until somebody comes up with a price that I think is a competitive deal. This doesn't take much time. And I'm very clear that if the price changes, we will leave the dealership. Both times that we've bought our new cars, we were in the Toyota dealership for less than an hour and a half. And then we were driving off with our brand new car. So why do we decide to go the new cow route? Well, initially we had the used car, and you know what? It died at 150,000 miles. We got it at like 135,000 miles, and an engine chain broke in the Nissan Altima we had driven for 2 years. And during those 2 years, we easily sunk $1,500 in repairs during that time. And it was incredibly stressful not knowing if our car would have trouble again. It also sucked up precious time while we were in training on our Saturdays, where it was our only car and we would just have to sit in a dealership all Saturday waiting for it to be fixed. So buying new works best if you plan to keep the car for a long time and you get a fair price for it. Our Toyota Yaris was about $14,000 after competitive bidding, brand new. And used cars with 60,000 miles at the time were about $10,000. After 8 years of owning this car, we've put about 80,000 miles on it. So that 60,000 mile car, used car that we were looking at, that actually added up to about 6 years worth of usage of that car. We can easily get another 8 years out of the car we currently have. So I'm sorry, probability-wise, I don't trust that I could get 16 years out of a new car with 100,000 miles on it. I just don't. You're going to have more turnover with buying different cars because something crazy can happen, like an engine chain can break. There's a much higher risk that things will break down with more miles on the car. So I really value having reliability and simplicity. And I think that can be done in a financially sensible way if you're buying a car brand new. Thanks for letting me challenge your sacred cow. I appreciate that we can crowdsource this podcast and think critically about the decisions we make.
Marilyn, I loved this voicemail. This is the first time I'm hearing it, actually, when we're recording this episode. I have a smile on my face the entire time because, honestly, I'm going through that and listening to you and agreeing with essentially every single point. So first off, let me say I did the exact same thing. So this was well before FI, in fairness. So I'm not sure if it came to buying a new car a year from now or 4 years from now, whatever it may be, if I would buy new or used. But I can tell you for sure, in August of 2003, I went down to the Honda dealership and did almost the exact same thing you did. I got a great, great deal. It was the best deal that I could possibly find amongst all the dealerships. And it was on a super special. And I went up getting, I think it was 0.9% interest. And yeah, I just had a quote unquote car loan, which, as you said, da, 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 you know, like it's not about having a car loan. And I think Jonathan took some flack for this on one of our prior episodes, which I thought was really unfair because Jonathan has a car loan, right? But he didn't tell you what interest rate he's paying. Like, I don't even care. I don't know the answer. But if the answer is he's paying 0% interest or 0.9% interest, well, maybe that's a pretty good play, actually, right? Like, why would I take, in your case, $14,000 out of my bank account if the dealership's going to essentially give that money to me for free over a 5-year period? So I personally don't, in a vacuum, have a problem with a car loan. Because if it makes sense financially, it's always about the math, right? And I have had the exact same conversation, Marilyn, that you brought up here with my wife, Laura, which is we're in all likelihood going to buy a Honda or a Toyota when it comes time that one of our cars dies. But because those cars hold their value so well, you're really only getting a couple $1,000 discount, maybe $3,000 to $6,000 discount off the original sticker price if you can get a good deal. And like you said, with the rate that we drive, I drive 3,000 miles a year at this point. So to get a car with 60,000 miles that'll save me $2,000 to $6,000, that's going to be 20 years worth of driving. Right. As silly as that it sounds, and I know I drive much less than just about anybody, but I mean, that's a realistic thing to consider. In your case, that was going to take off 6 years worth of useful life. So is 6 years of useful life worth a couple $1,000s? No. I mean, I would buy the car in that scenario too. And I loved how you went through that competitive bidding process. And what's so interesting actually is I mentioned Bo earlier in this podcast, and we had an email series back and forth about almost precisely this, where him and I, we think very similarly. And I had mentioned, he somehow brought this up in passing. And I mentioned how I wanted to do this when we were getting new air conditioners a couple of years ago. I wanted to get like 5 to 10 different estimates and then literally mass email. This was my grand plan. And I'll tell you, it did get kind of nixed by Laura here, unfortunately, but to get 5 to 10 estimates and just say there was no big need. It wasn't, the thing didn't die. We just knew it was reaching at the end of its useful life. And just say essentially that, which is anytime in the next 6 months, any given day, we will have you do this work for X price. And that price would have been, let's say, I don't know, 10 to 25% below the lowest offer we got. And I'm ready to pull the trigger at any given moment. And I feel like that would have really, really worked. And what's funny is Bo actually responded saying, regarding the mass email to competitors, I think we are wired the same. the one time I bought a new car, I did all my normal research, got lots of quotes, et cetera. And then I emailed all the dealerships within 25 miles, literally all of them, and said that I would buy the car from the first dealer that offered it at X price. No further negotiations or the deal was off. About 10 minutes later, I had my car at a rock bottom price and was stoked at the time, but never planned to buy a new car again. So yeah, it's cool that a lot of us are definitely thinking in a similar fashion here. And my challenge to the audience is find ways where you can take advantage of this. And it does take a little bit of courage. In my scenario, I would have emailed 10 different companies all in one mass email to let them know, hey, there's some competition for this. And the first person that offers it, like I said, on any given day, I will pull the trigger. But my challenge again to the audience is find places in your life where you're thinking about making a major purchase. It might be some kind of renovation for your house. It might be a car. It might be, who knows? It could be anything. But see if you can implement this. And I guarantee you, you can save easily 10 to 20% off of the price. And it could be a nice kind of outside of your comfort zone challenge. So anyway, Jonathan, now that I yammered on for a while, what were your thoughts about Marilyn's voicemail?
Yeah, she crushed it. I loved it. And I think that one, we should like dedicate a segment to crushing sacred cows. You know, like we just don't have any. So we do not have any. You got to make the case, though. Marilyn did an amazing job on the case. There is no debate. But I think it's that once you move past her initial point, you actually see how much we actually had in common. Like, for instance, she says the two new cars that they own has a Yaris and a Scion XB. I went ahead and just Google imaged those while we were listening to that voicemail. And those are two hatchback gas sippers. So if you listen to the end of our episode, we basically said, if you're going to get a car, go with a gas sipper hatchback. I mean, so she is clearly optimizing her life around that concept. And then if you can make the case based on the math to go new, I think she's winning. Absolutely. I take no issue with that across the board. And if I were looking at that exact same math, and you're telling me that I can get a brand new car with no miles for $14,000, or I can get a used car with 60,000 miles for $12,000, I'm probably going to go new. I think that's what I would do. And then the other point of that, she's leveled up with the competitive bidding. I have never done that. And there's a part of me that's just so bad at negotiating in person. I just don't want to like screw anybody over. And that's just my own personal thing. I get that. But I'm willing to, I mean, I realize I'm leaving money on the table. So I think I would be willing to do like this mass email scenario. It might be a situation in which I would be willing to give that a shot, even though in person, I can't be as hardcore as I would like to be. Behind the power of my computer, I can send out my hardcore ultimatum emails and see what comes back. So I loved everything about this. It really was a useful value-added voicemail. And thank you, Marilyn, for taking the time to send that to us. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a couple minutes and talk about our frugal wins of the week. I told you about mine at the beginning of the episode, but we had several more in our Facebook group. And if you want to join that conversation, please, please join us. We want you to be there with us. And to get on that Facebook group, just go to chooseify.com/Facebook. There's a simple opt-in form and we'll send you the invite. So hopefully we'll see you there. Christy says, I needed a new bed frame for my son. First thought was to buy one on Amazon, but I took Frugal Wood's advice to see if I could find one for free or used. Found one in the Facebook marketplace, contacted the seller, and she ended up giving it to us for free. I love free. And then Wes says, my frugal win of the past week was buying a nice 2-year-old Weber gas grill off of Craigslist for 2/5 of the cost of a new one. After a little cleaning and elbow grease, it's looking really nice and very nearly new. Definitely worth the money saved. And can I just take a second and say that the Weber charcoal grill, even not even the gas one, but the Weber charcoal grill is my favorite grill of all time. And I have a gas one and a charcoal grill. And the more I spend time learning how to actually grill stuff outdoors, I see the value in just even the cheapest version of the Weber charcoal grill. That is one of my favorite barbecue appliances that I own.
That's cool. I'll have to look into that for sure. All right. And the last frugal win of the week we have is from Brian. And he said, so I think I've got a frugal win for you guys. My wife and I are always looking for something to do on the weekends. The problem is most of the time, quote, something to do ends up costing thousands of dollars in bikes, golf clubs, cameras, etc. And while all these are very fun, none of them are all that financially responsible. Lately, we've picked up playing disc golf again. And I have to say, I think it fits in pretty nicely into this FI ecosystem. It plays just like golf, except you are throwing discs, which are special frisbees, at chain baskets. It costs about $20 for a beginner set of discs. And even when you get really into it, you don't spend more than $25-ish for the top-end discs. Once you have your discs, it's free to play literally thousands of courses across the country. And yeah, that's really cool, Brian. I like the sound of that. I've always seen those baskets, but I wasn't 100% positive what people – I guess I've never seen anybody actually playing. So yeah, I'll have to look into that. That would be fun.
And I think University of Richmond, your alma mater, actually has a disc frisbee course. And there's a few other here in Richmond. And it is fantastic exercise. I've done it a couple times. And I think it speaks to a larger concept. In fact, this may be a whole podcast that I'd like to see us do at some point on how to pick your hobbies wisely. Because he has found something that is essentially free, is exercise, and can be a community or family-based event. And those are the sorts of ideas that you want to start latching onto and finding more of those.
Yeah, I really like this from Brian. I think it's important to find things that are going to challenge you, get you off the couch, get you healthier. And if you can do it and save a lot of money, or if not save a lot of money, then just not spend a lot of money, then that's a huge win. I mean, so many people get into very expensive hobbies. And while they might be enjoyable, they might add value to their lives. I mean, to go into, like Jonathan's mentioned, you know, golf. I mean, people spend thousands of dollars on golf. And not to pick on that clearly, but there are many of these, or really there are much worse examples of people who sit on the couch all day. And that is not something we advise here. This is at least the way that we approach FI, is it's this holistic journey just to become better in life. So if you can find ways to be active, be healthy, do it with your spouse or significant other, and, you know, go out and play disc golf like this, you know, like Brian's mentioning, then, I mean, that's a huge win. So yeah, I definitely love that, and would really enjoy hearing other options of frugal activities and hobbies from the audience. So definitely send it to us in the Facebook group or via email.
This episode does have to come to a close, and we like to close every episode by featuring some feedback that we got as part of our drawing for a copy of J.L. Collins' book, The Simple Path to Wealth. And if you want to enter that drawing, you can go to choosefi.com/iTunes. Just leave us a short written review and then just send us a message letting us know that you did that. We'll enter you in a drawing, and we announce that drawing every week on the Friday Roundup.
Yeah. And once you leave your review on iTunes or Stitcher, just shoot us an email at feedback@choosefi.com and just let us know like your screen name, just so we can match it up and put you into the drawing. And yeah, I did want to mention this week, we give away one book for every 5 written reviews that we receive. And you send it to us at feedback@choosefi.com. This week, while we got a lot of reviews on iTunes, only 4 people sent us an email, actually. So I mean, we would love to give away these books. So please be sure to send us an email. You don't have to send a screenshot like we used to do. Just send us your screen name, and that way we can match it up so we can get more of these books in your hands. So this week, because of that, we're only giving away one book, and the winner is Brian. And Brian left this on Stitcher, and he said, "I have found my FI home. Brad and Jonathan make me feel like I am back in school. I leave every episode with a list of notes involving different websites, blogs, and concepts to research. They provide so much information in every episode and break it down in a way which is easy to understand. I'm working to incorporate as many of the changes to my life as I can while using this podcast to get my fiance excited about the FI community. Keep up the great work." Yeah, that's awesome, Brian. Thank you. And yeah, we'll send the book out to you very shortly. So congrats and enjoy.
All right, my friends, the fire is spreading, and we'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.